Well, the markets have been resilient since the April lows were put in, probably more so than the nerves of investors. And we're hearing it from investors who are concerned about further downside risk, but also at the same time, fear of missing out. Is the market moving higher, or will we return back to the April lows? That's a big question for most investors. As a result, we're seeing a big response or a big interest in buffer ETFs, or what's also called defined outcome ETFs. They're definitely having a moment at this time. And we're going to look at how we look at these products and how advisors can frame these products as they're working with clients. We'll go over all of this in today's episode of the FactSet Insight podcast. Welcome to our listeners who are joining us. I'm Lois Gregson, the senior ETF analyst at FactSet. Joining me to discuss buffer ETFs is Elizabeth Kashner, the VP Director of Global Fund Analytics at FactSet. Welcome, Elizabeth, and thank you for joining me today.
Lois, I'm so delighted to be chatting with you today. Thank you so much for inviting me.
So buffer ETFs, or like I said, defined outcome ETFs, the first one launched way back at very late 2018 already. So very late that year, 2018, 2019, started to see some begin to be offered by Innovator. With the increased market uncertainty recently, they seem to have boomed during 2024, just in terms of the number of launches that became available or number of funds that became available, and also the amount of assets. Now over 400 products currently out there trading, 12 different issuers. Recently, BlackRock issued a note that suggested this space could grow to $650 billion by 2030, or three times the size it is right now. So definitely an area of interest or something we'd like to explore more. You recently wrote a blog in regards to comparing the total cost of buffer ETFs to T-bills, which is kind of interesting. I'd kind of like to see how your experience is. What made you look at these products, or what piqued your interest?
Oh, Lois, thank you for asking. And, you know, it's so funny that you brought us back all the way back to 2018. you know, in 2018 and the beginning of 2019, my husband and I, we had three kids living in our home, a mixture of middle schoolers and high schoolers. You know, Lois, you haven't aged a bit since then, but my kids have really grown up beautifully. They've all left home. Two are college graduates with careers of their own, and one is just completed her first year of college and, you know, has much more education ahead of her. But they don't live with us anymore. And so my husband and I took a look at our big old three-story house, and we said, you know, these four walls have done us a solid, enabling us to raise this large family and launch them into the universe, but they're not the right size and shape for the next few decades of our lives. Mm-hmm. And so we went and bought ourselves a fixer-upper about a mile away. It's a great size and shape for this empty nest phase of our life. But it also, you know, kind of meant a change in our risk profile in our investment portfolio. You know, my husband and I, we continue to work. There's a lot of life in me yet, even though there's left the house. And
it's just beginning.
That's right, because I'm 40, Lois. That's exactly right. Life begins at 40. You know, all through our working lives and up until the moment we hired an architect, you know, we were able to take a very long-term perspective on our investment portfolio because, you know, we could live off of our income and save a decent chunk. And our investment time horizon was pretty far out. And that allowed us to do two things, right? One is to be comfortable with our asset allocation. And the other was to take the long view during market corrections and to remind ourselves that, you know, the market goes up, the market goes down. When it goes down, it can go down quite sharply. It can be very scary. But we've been able to take a deep breath and say, hey, we don't need that cash right now. You know, we can continue to follow our plan. We've even been able to rebalance into equities on occasion when the market has been at a low point. And we were really proud of that. We were proud of the staying power that we had during scary times. But I have to tell you, on a personal level, knowing that we were going to need a decent chunk of cash to fund renovations in this fixer-upper, and that time horizon was measured in months, not decades, it really changed things for me. And my husband and I started the conversation about changing our asset allocation slightly so that we had enough cash at the ready to fund these renovations. And so that is what kind of drove me to certainly look at the idea of going into T-bills or a very short-term government fund or a money market type fund. But, you know, as you said, Lois, nobody can ignore the buffer products, and especially with the FOMO that you mentioned, fear of missing out, you know, the idea of being able to potentially have a, you know, zero risk floor and at least some market upside. It was really appealing. You know, my husband's always been a bit of an aggressive bidder when we play bridge, and, you know, he's always kind of believed in being in the equity market, and he, you know, wanted some convincing about this going to cash thing. And so I thought this might be a really good compromise for our use case and our personalities.
Well, I think that's where a lot of investors like yourself, I mean, they're getting to that point where maybe their investment horizon is changing, shorter in nature. And these volatilities are just too much to take. You know, they want some more certainty in this. But yes, do you just sit in cash? That was the alternative, or that was, you know, what they're thinking. Buffers have definitely been something that investors are wanting. Most advisors, you know, maybe look to the traditional kind of, you know, like you said, money markets, pulling some out of cash or pulling some into cash, or annuities. Also, that's what these products have kind of been competing against, in terms of giving some kind of stay in the market, get some participation, but yet have some downside protection. So interesting to find yourself in that same place. So you're not unlike so many of the other investors out there.
We all like to think we're special, Lois.
That's right. Okay. So how did you go about it? So you did have some choices. You were thinking about cash, T-bills, but these buffer products, kind of thought maybe worth taking a look at or doing some comparison. You kind of outlined a rather lengthy process for, you know, a good due diligence process. Maybe you can give us, what approach did you take? How did you first evaluate these and do the comparison?
Well, Lois, to be perfectly honest, I struggled for many days to figure out the right analytical framework for this. And, you know, you and I, we've been in the ETF due diligence business for decades. And another thing that you and I have in common, you know, I know you pretty well, is we have a background in options trading, right? Mm-hmm. So we really know our stuff in terms of how options work. It's easy to forget because they're complicated, but, you know, I feel like I had a pretty solid background for approaching these products, and still I found it overwhelming and confusing to understand what data I needed to collect and how to go about things. And I want to be really upfront about my struggle, because I feel like it's a reflection of the complexity of the product and the way that the asset managers do or don't talk about them. Once I kind of got my bearings, I realized I needed a two-step process. Okay. One was sort of more in our wheelhouse ETF due diligence, figure out, you know, what is the small subset of products that actually fit this use case, and do a comparison of them in terms of total annual cost of ownership and portfolio exposure, to see if I could get this overwhelming field of 400 plus defined outcome products, mm-hmm. maybe down to a smaller choice set, and then pick the best of the bunch. After that, I put that one, the sort of best in class, I put it up against a T-bill of like very comparable maturity. I couldn't find an absolute date match, but it was within a week. It's pretty good. Mm-hmm. It's Christmas versus New Year's. And then take a look at the upside downside profile and decide which risk profile seemed better suited for my husband and me.
For your need or your risk level. Because I think that's what I want to point out too. Well, first, the name that's typically, you know, we hear of buffer, we hear of defined outcome. I always kind of found it a little bit funny to have defined outcome as the name on these things, because really the only thing that's defined on these is the outcome period or like the time or term of these protective types of, whether it's a buffer or whether it's a protected downside type of approach. The outcome itself definitely is not defined unless, you know, the only thing is usually most of these, you know, you can find them for a year, you can find them for a quarter, you can find them for 6 months, or now you're going out a year or 2 years. So the length of time is always defined. But that's kind of, like I said, that's a little bit, I think, misleading in terms of outcome. I don't know that that's the necessary outcome you're looking for. So, but I think that's a good approach for your particular application. You first looked at what's all about out there and it's available, but then what is your use? What are you trying? You knew you were going to have a need, right?
Yeah. And you know, Lois, I think you've also really underlined how, like, just what we need to do to sift through this universe. There's a whole mess of reset dates or, you know, mm-hmm. lengths of the options contract. There's a whole mess of the options spread strike prices, which sort of lines up with how much protection, how much upside have you given up in exchange? You know, what are the mm-hmm. possible range of outcomes? So for me, because this was like a real life, honey, we're going to need cash situation. Mm-hmm. I really focused on a small subset of all of these buffer products. I focused on the ones that in their names provide 100% downside protection. Okay. Meaning, yeah. You know, after costs, you can't lose any more money.
Right.
Right. Okay. We'll still have some upside, but after costs, you know, you know how many dollars you're going to get out. Because those, to me, are the most similar to a T-bill, right?
Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. You're right.
Barring some massive default on the part of the federal government, in which case, boy, do we have additional problems.
Let's you're not go there.
You're going to get 100 cents on the dollar for your T-bill. And so these were relatively comparable products. There's lots that have different types of downside protection and upside retention. Mm-hmm. But, there was only a subset that worked for us. And, you know, just like you said, Lois, there's this long set of choices of what date the options reset. You know, I don't want to talk about the funds as if the funds themselves mature, right? They're not like bullet maturity funds, which have like literally a maturity date and you get cashed out
in principal return
court order after that maturity date is reached. What happens in these buffer products is the options contract expires. Mm-hmm. You know, you get cashed out at the value of your of each of the options if they closed in the money. And then, you know, the portfolio managers go out and enter into another 12-month options contract. It's not always 12 months. It's generally 12 months mm-hmm. options contract. And then you start all over again with a new downside layer, et cetera. Mm-hmm. For our case, we sort of roughly think we're going to begin construction right around the first of the year. So I looked at the series that mature. Oh, I just used the wrong word, Lois. I looked for the
easy
series.
To do.
So easy to do, right? I looked for the series where the underlying options matured on December 31 or January 1, the last day of 2025, first day of 2026. And once I did that, you know, two criteria, right? One is these have to offer 100% downside protection, and they have to have this December 31 options contract maturity date. Then, like, my little ETF due diligence brain settled a little bit, because I said, okay, at least, you know, I know my universe. And there were six products out there. So out of the 400 that you mentioned, there were six that met these criteria. I shaved one off because it had been, that options contract had been initiated 12 months prior to all of them. They had used 2-year flex options, and they were coming up with the final 7-8 months, and their buffers and caps were just way offset versus the existing ones. So that got me down to 5. I can do it. I can compare 5 ETFs. If I can't, I'm in the wrong business.
You've been doing a lot more than that. Yeah. So you narrowed it down to your 5. You finally, like you said, your 2 main objectives was really your time horizon and then your risk tolerance to get it down into that 5. All right. So what did you find?
So I, big exhale, okay. I know how to take care of this ETF due diligence, right? Now that the products are so very similar, I was going to look at the expense ratio, so the cost of holding them on an annualized basis. And I was going to look at the trading spread, meaning overall, what can I expect to pay to get in and out of the products? Right? For a user who actually has a longer term time horizon and is happy to take the annual flex options reset, you know, you might consider amortizing those spreads over a longer time horizon. But for me, like, I want that cash on December 31. So I know I'm doing two sides of a trade. And frankly, you know, holding it for less than a year, since we're mid-year already. So those trading spreads are a significant component of the cost analysis. Given the expense ratio and the trading spread, I was able to calculate on an annualized basis the total annual cost of ownership. And when I looked at that, there was a clear winner. The product, the contenders, we had one from First Trust, Calamos, Innovator, PGIM, and iShares. And the iShares one had a total annual cost of ownership of 67 basis points. The highest in the bunch was 107 basis points, so significantly more. And another thing that was interesting to me was understanding what the initial upside cap was. Since they all provided 100% downside protection, I wanted to look at what I might get on the upside. The iShares product was had significantly higher cap than the others did. All of the rest of them were between, say, 730 and 760 basis points, whereas the iShares product was 840. Now, you know, given that everybody is staring down the same flex options market, it does look like BlackRock iShares managed to get significantly better execution. I'm super curious why. I didn't ask why as part of this due diligence. So it's an open inquiry for me.
That's interesting, though, because obviously issuer does matter in these, because can they strike these agreements, these swap agreements of what they're using or to construct these buffers and caps makes a difference, because they are finding a trading partner to take that. So interesting to see.
Yeah, well, and it also means that any of the market makers who need to to deliver similar contracts as part of a creation process, you know, sure. also need to be able to replicate that exposure. And so you could, as a result, see some of the products trading at a premium or discount. You know, you could also see them trading at a premium or discount given changes in option valuation as time progresses.
One thing to notice about these, one thing we have been picking up on as we watch these products trade, specifically some of the issues or concerns that have come up from investors who have bought into these, they notice that I think when they buy them, they're expecting the volatility to be erased completely, that the position they put on is going to somehow just stay stable. I think important thing to point out about these is that they will continue to fluctuate with the market. And as the term gets closer to these outcome period date resets, you know, whether you're dealing with a quarterly, 6 month or annual product, as it approaches that reset date or that outcome period end, then it becomes more like that protection. You see that protection kind of kick in, or that cap really kind of kicking in. And again, it's that option, the nature of those options where, you know, when you still have some time, that fluctuation in those option premiums will continue to watch this product fluctuate. And I think that's something that investors really have to get comfortable with, where you are locking it in. You have to kind of trust. There is a certain amount of trust in these products, and that, okay, at maturity, a reset date, that's going to be the outcome that I desired, is that, you know, there's a floor or there's a cap and it's met by that. And it does. It just takes some time as you get closer to that reset period. I think in your case, especially since, again, you were dealing with some that had the 100% protection on the downside, it gave you some assurance, though, I think, is that as you got closer to the date of need, you were going to have that protection in place.
So 100% on that, Lois, mm-hmm. But you know, in the financial markets, hardly anything is free.
True. Right.
And that assurance came at a price, and that price was a lot higher than it had been at the previous reset date for the particular ETF that I was looking at. You know, I'm going to throw out a ticker here because it'll be easier to talk about. So in that five ETF smackdown where I picked one product that was from iShares that gave better cost and better upside, its ticker was D Max, I think D for December and Max for maximum buffer. And so I'm gonna call it by its nickname, D Max, as we go on. On the date that I chose to pull data to run my analytics of comparing D Max versus a T-bill, the underlying asset for DMAX, which is the ETF IVV, which is the iShares S&P 500 ETF, was at almost the exact same price where it was at the options contract initiation. It was only 51 basis points lower. So with all of the volatility that we'd seen between January 1 and May 12th, when I pulled all of my data, IVV was pretty much back to where it had started. And so you would think that the price of DMAX and its NAV, its net asset value, would also be pretty close to $25 a share, which is where it was at issuance, which, you know, issuance happened to be just, you know, December 31, January 1. But that was not the case. DMAX had appreciated 105 basis points. So its protection wouldn't even be needed until S&P 500 appreciated another 51 basis points. And yet, instead of that NAV being at 25, it was significantly higher. And that's attributable to options volatility.
Right.
Right. Because, you know, in all of the turmoil that we saw in the month of April, with the S&P just nosediving for a little bit and then recovering as we got into late April and May, you know, that options prices, and especially as you alluded, right, the price of the protective put in there was significantly higher than it had been back in December. So even though the protection was real, the amount of money that I was going to have to pay for that protection was significantly higher.
Higher. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And so what that added up to, once you had the prorated expense ratio, the non-prorated spreads cost, because I would still right. have to buy it and still have to sell it to get that cash out by year end, and the appreciation, the all-in costs were going to be 153 basis points. Which is well above posted expense ratio, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And if I can just go on, because we're yeah. almost ready for the punchline here, Lois. So in a down market situation, the protection of DMAX would wind up costing us 153 basis points. And so if the market did nothing but sink between now and year end, well, I should really say between May 12th when I did the analysis and year end,
right.
my husband and I would have paid 153 basis points for the privilege of not losing anything additional.
Mm, right. Right.
Mm-hmm. Whereas buying a T-bill, we would have paid nothing.
Right.
Because, you know, we have a brokerage platform where we're able to get T-bills at auction and there's no additional commissions charged. Isn't that nice? Mm-hmm. So in a really down market, there's no question we would be better off in a T-bill. Mm-hmm. But, you know, one of the appeals of going into DMAX or its ilk would be the FOMO argument that you talked about. Well, what if markets, you know, rise significantly? And to be fair, that's pretty much what we've seen
right.
between mm-hmm. May 12th and today, which is June 16th that we're doing this recording. And so there really is an upside. And once you adjust for all of the expenses that we would incur in putting on and getting out of that DMAX position, you know, we could earn net 687 basis points in DMAX, whereas the max that we would get back in the T-bill was only 260 basis points. Mm-hmm. So there we had it. There was the decision matrix.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, that's good. Well, again, for something that you already had, again, what you were using the money for really made that determination for you. You knew that you really weren't concerned with so much of the upside. You were putting it into something else, you know, in a 6-month period, a different investment, so if you will. So that's your trade-off, or that's your consideration there.
You know, that's my consideration in a tax-free world.
True.
But that's not the world that you and I live in, Lois, mm-hmm. right? So the tax treatment of the gains was something that I had to consider. And I live in a high tax state. I live in the state of California. California's tax revenue largely depends on capital gains income, right? Especially okay. as everybody exposed to the tech industry cashes in their options, they take a capital gain, and voila, that's
there's
what
sure.
fills up the California mm-hmm. Treasury. So so I would be foolish to ignore the tax consequences. Mm-hmm. And the way it looks is you have to compare the tax treatment of a T-bill versus the tax treatment of a buffer ETF. The T-bill interest is all taxed as ordinary income. So whatever my husband and my marginal mm-hmm. income tax rate, that's what we're charged on for the T-bill. If we were to incur a long-term capital gain, that's a much lower tax rate at the federal level, a max rate of 23.8%, depending on your tax bracket. But for us, this would be a short-term capital gain because
right.
it would be held for less than 12 months. Right. And so that also is taxed at ordinary income rates. However, T-bill interest is only taxed at the federal level. It's not taxable at the state level. Capital gains, different story, right? So in our case, it's actually more expensive to hold on a tax basis that income that we would earn from a buffer ETF would go a little bit less far compared to a T-bill.
Let's recap some of this and highlight some things that we have here at FactSet as well. As we first noted, there's now over 400 products and they continue to expand. You know, 12 different issuers launching products on every month, you know, automatically times 12, then gets kind of very quickly a lot to handle, a lot to sort through. We do have a screener at FactSet, an ETF screener that allows you to sort. I would suggest sorting by the strategy itself, first of all. We usually have these classified as either a buy right or a collar strategy, two different strategies, but all would fall under the either buffer or, you know, the what they call defined outcome ETFs. And again, it gets at what kind of level of protection you're looking for. A true collar would put in a floor or put a stop on the losses at that point. Both cap the upside, but it allows you to look at the funds, pull them out from the broader, you know, 4,000 ETFs that are currently available. And again, defined outcome or buffer ETFs can be found either as a buy right or a collared strategy. And then it's a matter of what's your duration or what's your time horizon for the investment too. Most of them are specified in their name, what month they reset, the exposure period. So you can kind of get an idea of what month you're looking for. And again, whether it's a buy right or a collar kind of gives you an indication of to where that downside protection either kicks in or how much is there for protection. So that's one way to look at that. In addition to that, what other suggestions would you have that maybe advisors should consider when they're looking at those products or filtering through the universe?
I think you made an excellent point, Lois, about the investor's time horizon, right? Because these flex contracts reset every year, mm-hmm. you can't just look at something and assume that those terms and conditions are going to hold across a multi-year holding period, right? So right. It's more of a stair-step function of what gets locked in on an annual basis rather right. than a starting point function. And then I do think it's worth kind of going through on a step-by-step basis, as I did, you know, what level of protection are you looking for? What trade-off are you willing to make on the upside? How long? What is the tax picture at both the federal and the state level? Mm-hmm. Right? Because in my case, the state level analysis was a real game changer. And then it's just a risk trade-off. You know, the one thing that I would say is I had a very simple comparison case. Once I selected the best ETF in, you know, amongst those five or six, mm-hmm. it was pretty clear, like, here's the T-bill, here's the date that it matures, you know, it's within spitting distance of that December 31 contract maturity date. You know, what's the upside? What's the downside? What are the costs? What are they after tax? Okay, go, no go. But a lot of the others don't have as clear cut a comparison. For the ones that have, you know, less protection and therefore more equity downside exposure and maybe also greater equity upside exposure in exchange, I think you have to look at it at least in part as a substitute for a core equity holding, right? And then I think you have to remember that the flex options are written on the price of the index, right? The S&P okay. 500 level, or in this case, the price of IVV. Mm-hmm. No distributions are included, right? And so you have to look not just at the expense ratio, not just at the spreads cost, not just at the terms and conditions of the options, but what you would be giving up if you just accepted the volatility and held the underlying asset. Right. And sometimes what I like to think about is term life insurance. You know, again, I mentioned that my husband and I, we raised three children. And when I was pregnant with the first, we looked at each other and we said, honey, we need life insurance. No, I 100% do not want to raise this child alone without you if something bad happens. And the only thing I want less than that is to be financially stressed along the way. Right. So we both shopped for and bought term life insurance. And as far as insurance products go, term life is relatively inexpensive when you're in your childbearing years. The insurance that is embedded in these flex option spreads is so much more expensive, right? And I think you can often make the case, like take a look at two bad outcomes. Bad outcome A, equity markets are down 20% this year. Bad outcome B, the family breadwinner drops dead. Like, which one is worse for the family? Like, in almost all cases, the breadwinner dropping dead is worse, yet the insurance against a short-term portfolio correction is far more expensive. So I think it's worth looking at it in that framework and potentially being able to have a conversation with your clients that brings the cost of insurance to the forefront. And, you know, is that protection worth the risk? Or given your time horizon and your wealth level, are you able to tolerate some fluctuations in the equity market?
Right. It would, again, for a lot of investors who are either close to retirement, entering retirement, that risk tolerance changes. As you said, you know, it's different from when you're in your childbearing years, obviously, and, you know, potential for income ahead of you. For those that maybe, again, their risk tolerance will change, something that they have to consider. So maybe it is worth capping. You know, they're not worried about any upside. I just really want to protect what I have, but yet maybe stay invested. Better than putting it in cash.
Maybe better than putting it in cash, and maybe after all of the costs, not better. You know, in the end, my husband and I decided against. We decided that the upside was not worth the known and definite costs. And so we decided to forego some equity upside on this chunk of money for a period of months in exchange for, you know, modest income from a T-bill. So others would make a different choice, I imagine. And that's, you know, when I wrote the blog, I sort of left it open of like, well, what would you choose? Just because my husband and me didn't think the upside was worth the cost doesn't mean that everybody else would make that same decision. I suppose my plea to advisors out there is to do your very best to lay out all of the costs and all of the risks and the upside downside matrix, and, you know, help your clients make as informed a decision as possible.
Good point. Yeah, that's what it always comes down to. It, many of the issuers do put on their websites too. Each day they update where these products are, you know, where the cap is, where the downside protection is. But it is still a matter of taking in total cost, as Elizabeth did, you know, as she has explained about the expense ratios and about the spread. And, you know, there's more to it than just maybe what's the upside cap and downside protection. Elizabeth, thank you for your insight. And thank you for going through the process of actually applying it to a situation, a real life situation, and how to evaluate these products and really what to compare it to. What are the things to take into consideration? It's always so fascinating to watch you work and go through this information. So a good service there. But for advisors who may be listening to this, know that there are tools available to you to outline these things, make it a little bit easier. Know that this space is just continuing to expand. So it's not going away. It's only going to expand and get bigger. So there's opportunity there. Maybe it's not just downside protection. It's income now we're kind of getting into. Maybe there's some defined income strategies. So there's lots of things out there to consider and lots of alternatives. And I have to say, it just gets better, the options that are available to clients. So we wish you well and success with these products. And it's exciting, something to watch. Again, Elizabeth, thank you for your time.
Lois, thank you so much for inviting me. You know, to the advisors who are listening out there, if you want to like read through and see what analytical framework I used, you can go on to FactSet Insight, search for my last name, Kashner, and you should find this blog come up. The title is Buffer ETFs versus T-bills, a total cost of ownership perspective. And I would love your feedback on, you know, does this analytical framework make sense? Is this the right conversation to be having? Have I missed something important? What would you do if you like really took the time to dig in and ask the questions?
Fantastic. And thank you again.
Thank you, Lois.
The FactSet Insight podcast is for informational purposes only. The information contained within is not legal, tax, or investment advice. FactSet does not endorse or recommend any investments and assumes no liability for any consequence relating directly or indirectly to any action or inaction taken based on the information contained in this podcast episode. The views shared by third-party contributors do not necessarily reflect the opinion of FactSet.